This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dmitry Sitkovetsky, grew up in the Soviet Union, where he was one of the most promising young violinists. And he was from one of the most prominent musical families there. He's the son of the late violinist Julian Sitkovetsky and the pianist Bela Davidovich, who for 16 years was a soloist with the Leningrad Philharmonic. In 1976, at the age of 22, Dmitry left the Soviet Union for the United States. His mother followed 2 years later. They've both established themselves as important musicians in the West, as soloists and as a duo. In 1988, Dmitry performed in the Soviet Union by official invitation from the Soviet government. He was the first Soviet emigre violinist since World War II invited back to perform. Before we meet him, let's hear an excerpt from his most recent recording. This is the Allegro from Violin Concerto No. 2 in C-sharp minor by Dmitry Shostakovich. Andrew Davis conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Any plans to go back to the Soviet Union this year?
This year, I don't have any immediate plans to go back because the situation is there is rather changing almost daily, and everything seems very difficult to arrange in practical matters. I mean, they can't guarantee any, you know, hotels or any kind of arrangement that were done when I was there twice before. But so at the moment, it's kind of wait and see. Period, you know, what happens there. But if it settles down one way or the other, I might go back. Usually the time when I go there is between Christmas and New Year, around that time.
Have any concerts been getting postponed, canceled?
Oh, yes, a lot, quite a bit, because there were a number of tours were going to take place, and they simply cannot manage now anything because they never had enough hotels and any kind of facilities that way. And now, of course, everyone who'd gone to Russia since I was there last, which just a little over a year ago, they keep telling me that the situation is really almost unmanageable, and it's very, very difficult to tour that country right now.
Why do you think the Soviet government invited you back in December of 88 to perform?
I think what happened was that somewhere in the middle through that perestroika and glasnost process, they figured that the emigres living in the West were actually an asset rather than, you know, somebody to ignore, which they did for a number of years, all of us. They at the beginning, you know, whoever left, Stislav Rostropovich, Baryshnikov, my mother, Bela Davidovich, they simply erased our names from the books, you know, from the history of this Soviet musical life. And at some point, you know, towards the end of 80s, they figured that that was not very intelligent, because it's much better to welcome, you know, most of us, the ones who are fairly well known in the West and, you know, did well in immigration, and, you know, invite them back and just be the big guys, you know, sort of say, listen, you've left, but you've carried the torch of Soviet art, of Russian art, and so to speak, you know, and carried it all through the world. And now we welcome you home and come and play now for your own people and so forth. So I think that was basically a change in policy, though I don't think at that point it happened, you know, sort of as a decision that was made and then implemented everywhere. Because by the time I came to Russia, which was the end of 88, things were already getting chaotic.
Now, I know your late father was one of the Soviet Union's foremost violinists, your mother, one of the foremost pianists. Did they encourage you to start playing when you were really young, or did you pick that up on your own?
I really almost didn't have a choice but to become a musician. The only choice I had was between the violin and the piano, because in my family, I happen to be the fourth generation of professional musicians. You see, my mother's grandfather even was a professional musician. He was actually a violinist. He was a concertmeister of the Baku Opera House. And my father's family, all string players. And my mother's side, outside of that great-grandfather of mine, they were all pianists. So really, it was just a sort of a, you know, I was in the middle of all of that, and I really didn't have much of a choice. Not that I regretted it much later on, though I had my doubts at some point.
Well, if your choice was between violin or piano, how did it end up being the violin that you played?
Well, I think the choice was made for me at that point, because I was given, you know, a violin when I was, I suppose, 4 and a half. And they took me to a wonderful pedagogue, Yuri Yankelevich, who taught many of the very distinguished Russian violinists. And he in turn, gave me, you know, for 6 months to his assistant. And he said, well, let's get him started. And in 6 months, I'll tell you whether he'd be, you know, he'd have a chance. And then at the same time, I was taken to a piano teacher who taught Vladimir Ashkenazy. And she was ready to take me into her class without sort of any kind of a waiting period. But 6 months later, that pedagogue, Yuri Yankelevich, he insisted that I should study violin. And he felt that I had some kind of promise. And, you know, and then, of course, family's wish was very much for me to take up the violin rather than the piano, because by that time, my father was already no longer alive. And so to sort of carry the torch of the family, I was sort of destined to be.
How old were you when your father died?
I was 3 and a half.
Oh, you were that young.
Right.
You know, it must have been kind of rough to be really young and have teachers appraising you to see, does he have it or not? Will he make it or not?
I'll tell you, that was probably at 4 and a half was not as tough as later on, because they were constantly comparing me to my father and expecting me to walk on water at the age of whatever, you know. They were expecting me to be nothing short of child prodigy, and that's a lot of pressure to put on a little boy growing up. So that was very much a rat race in that respect, and it sort of came with the territory. On one hand, we had this fantastic tradition of the best possible violin school or string school in the world, and the best schools and everything. Free education, what have you. On the other hand, it was very, very competitive.
Did that competition and pressure ever overshadow your love of the music?
Not my love of the music, but my love of violin, yes, sometimes it did. And sort of my mid-teens, you know, sort of 13 to 15, 16, I was not a very happy individual, because I just thought that, you know, it really isn't worth the effort, because you know, everybody expected me to you know, you can ask any child who followed, you know, a parent who played the same instrument or did the same thing. I'm sure it's the same in the, you know, in the acting profession, and the answer will always be, you know, it's tremendous pressure. And having my father, who was by that time, you know, who was not playing, he was a legend in Russia, and there were only records left and, you know, memories. And so I could never really live up to those expectations. So when I did leave Russia in 77, I left behind a lot of that as well.
My guest is Soviet emigre violinist Dmitry Sitkovetsky. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Violinist Dmitry Sitkovetsky is my guest. When did you start to think about leaving the Soviet Union?
I would say probably early 70s, because they began to allow immigration mostly of the Jewish people, Soviet Jews from Russia via Israel, or to Israel or via Israel to other places. So that really started in 72, 73. So, you know, a number of my friends or colleagues or acquaintances began to leave the country, and it sort of, you know, registers in your mind and you begin to take notice and think about it. And then, of course, in 75, I came out for the first time to the West and sort of saw it for myself, what that was like, and that certainly made an impression. And then by that time, by 76, I think I probably made up my mind already. And it took about a year and a half for me to complete that.
Was it hard for you to get permission to emigrate?
Yes. Yes, in terms of it was a very involved process. And since I was known, you know, most of my professional life in Russia because of my parents, and then probably a little bit because of my own activities, there was very little chance that they would just simply let me go if I say, well, I'm leaving for Israel, goodbye.
Because it would make them look bad, like, if this was such a good place to live, why would he want to leave?
Right, and also, you know, I was, you know, one of the hopeful talents that were trained to bring in, you know, fame and glory for the Soviet art, as well mm-hmm. as hard currency from the West.
Right.
And, you know, they've invested with their free education and so whatnot in me, and all of a sudden I'm just leaving, you know. So they wouldn't have been too happy about it. So my plan was to, in a way, to mislead them, to make them believe that I was no longer valuable to them as an asset.
How'd you do that?
I
play a lot of clinkers.
No, I didn't do that. I just didn't play at all. I stopped playing for about a year and a half. I didn't play a note in public, and I actually went to a hospital to you know, to do a series of tests, and so the rumor was that I was, you know, I had some kind of a special tendonitis that which enabled me, you know, which more or less made playing the violin impossible. And because I wasn't playing any public concerts, nobody could check whether I practiced or not, you know, made them believe that I was pretty much finished. Then I applied to leave. And then they thought that I was just sort of being desperate and trying maybe to find the cure in the West, which indeed I did.
Well, did you really have a problem, or did you imagine? Was this problem purely to lead them astray?
It was, you know, 90% of it is just to lead them astray.
And 10%?
10%, you know, every string player could have a potential problem with the tendonitis because of a very unnatural way you hold the violin. So, I mean, there was a certain, you know, at some point years ago, I had some, a little bit of a history of having these problems. I mean, almost every string player does or did at some point. So, I mean, it was based on something. But the expertise that I've gotten from the doctors was certainly a friendly gesture on that part rather than the real state of affairs.
So the doctors were in on this?
Yeah.
You know, you said no one would know whether you were practicing or not. I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that, since my understanding is that everybody in the Soviet Union at that time was always afraid of being bugged by the KGB.
Right, but you see, I had a lot of... I didn't have to practice at my own house, or at the house, at the apartment where I lived. I had a lot of relatives and friends where, you know, I could go. I went actually to the South and rented a place there where I practiced. And there, I don't think I was being, you know, under surveillance all the whole time. I wasn't really a dissident or anything, you know. I don't think they would investigate up to a point, but they couldn't watch every single move of everybody. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration.
So when you got to the States and you started studying and then performing, did the Soviet authorities feel that they were duped? And was that ever taken out on your mother, the pianist Bela Davidovich, who remained in the Soviet Union?
Right. Well, they did take it out on her, because at first they thought that, you know, wasn't she wonderful? You know, I was leaving Russia and, you know, sort of an outcast, and she was staying. And when I made a decision, when I applied to leave, she was summoned to the, you know, to the head of Moscow Conservatory at that time. And he had a talk with her and said, well, listen, what's going to happen now? I mean, he's leaving now, and wouldn't you be following him? And she said, well, I have no plans like that. I continue. I hope to continue my life as it was before. I hope to continue my concerts in the Soviet Union as well as outside. I will continue teaching in Moscow Conservatory, because she was a professor there. And he was pretty much reassured, and, you know, she was looked at as somebody, you know, to respect. Well, the son made a decision. Well, that's sort of bad seed of the family. But, you know, she's still the Soviet artist with all the attributes. And then it would have been maybe like that for a while. But, you know, they didn't coordinate all their efforts. And whoever it was, KGB or the Ministry of Culture or whoever, they, at the last minute, they wouldn't let her go to just about the next trip, or within 6 months, that she was going to have concerts in.
So, so your mother was kind of punished for your emigration.
She was certainly. They certainly curtailed her activities. I mean, they stopped her tours abroad, and within the Soviet Union, once that happens, you sort of become, you know, some kind of a leper, you know, culturally. And so people begin to look the other way, and you lose, you know, a lot of your contacts and personal, you know, favors that are usually done to you, you know, no longer available. So within, you know, next few months, she made a decision to leave, as a, more or less as a result of that.
Was it hard for her to leave?
It certainly was much harder than for me, because she left, you know, so much more behind her. She was almost 50 years old when she left, and she certainly had a long and very successful career in the Soviet Union, and, you know, it was not easy for her to leave. For me, it was easier, because I left young and, you know, sort of didn't have that much to lose, but she certainly did. It was harder. It was more risky for her to leave. Fortunately, it turned out to be a success story on this side, but it certainly was very scary for her to leave at that time.
Did the authorities make it difficult for her to leave?
No, not once she applied. They sort of understood, and, you know, she already had her son over here, and if they did try to stop her, you know, from leaving, I was all ready to raise hell on this side, so they didn't really try.
So it must have been interesting, you know, a mother and son, very famous in the Soviet Union, now in the United States, where they were known but not nearly as well known as they had been in their home country. That must have had things that you appreciated about it, and things probably that you really missed about the notoriety that you had in the Soviet Union, the appreciation that you had in the Soviet Union.
Right. Especially, you know, in the case of my mother, and certainly the circle of friends and the support system that one does get, you know, once you're on a certain level. Of course, that was totally missing, and it was a completely different ballgame, so to speak. Here, the mechanics of a career are different here. The relationships between you know, the managers and the artists, also the orchestras or the conductors and the soloists are different here. So all of that we sort of had to learn on our own and separately, quite separately, because I'd been here already for almost 2 years, and I was in my last year at the Juilliard School when my mother arrived. And then I went on to Europe, and I based my career and my life, really, since last 10 years in Europe. But my mother stayed here in New York, and, you know, she was waiting for that debut at Carnegie Hall in October 79. And that was the beginning of her career in the West. And in America, in October 79, it's funny, because just the month before, you know, in September 79, I won my last competition in Vienna, the Chrysler competition, and that was the beginning of my European career. So we sort of started almost practically at the same time, but on different sides of Atlantic. And so each one had to learn, you know, how to go about the Western career on our own. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when I came to the States in 77, hardly anyone really knew about my father or my mother, and they certainly didn't know anything about me. So that was, in a way, a blessing more than a curse in my case, because I really had to prove to myself what I was worth, you know, as an individual, rather than a dynasty, a member of a famous family.
And I guess people in America weren't always comparing you to your celebrated parents because your parents' work wasn't as well known here.
Absolutely. And that was an advantage as far as I was concerned. I mean, I was just building something from scratch and actually welcomed that, having had the pressure that I described earlier, you know, growing up under the shadow. There was no shadow. There was a tremendous competition otherwise, but, you know, that could be healthy, but, you know, shadows could be dangerous.
Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Violinist Dmitri Sitkovetsky. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.